A father asks forgiveness today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. More talk in London today about how to end the conflict in Syria. Meanwhile, a father in Aleppo worries for his family.
I have a daughter. She's 7 months.
Are you worried about her future living in Aleppo?
So much. I always ask her for forgiveness because I know that in the future this war will affect her so much.
Plus, it's been a year since a stampede in Mecca killed hundreds of Muslim pilgrims. We'll hear a survivor's account.
He was barely even aware of what was happening physically because in his mind, his only thought was, what's going to happen to my family? And I'm sure that this is my last day on Earth.
Those stories plus falcon hunting at the World Nomad Games in Kyrgyzstan. That's all ahead today on The World. We start today with Saudi Arabia and Iran, two nations that mistrust each other on opposite sides of Islam's Sunni-Shia divide. They often exchange insults, but this week they've really stepped it up. Saudi Arabia's top Sunni cleric ruled that Iran's Shia leaders are simply not Muslim. Iran's president replied by calling for Saudi leaders to be punished for failing to safely organize the annual Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. Last year, there was a deadly stampede at the Hajj. Hundreds of pilgrims died, more than 2,000 total by some accounts, and many of the dead were Iranian. Vali Nasser has been following all of this closely. He's the author of The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future, just republished this week. So let's start with the Saudi charges, Vali, that Iran's leaders are fire worshippers, not Muslim. Where did that come from?
Well, generally, this is a view that Saudi Arabia's brand of Islam Wahhabism holds about Shiites, that they are not genuine Muslims. And this has been a staple of sectarian rhetoric in the region. However, usually we haven't had a case where Saudi clerics would say this publicly about Iran's leaders. And I think the reason for that is that the Iranian leaders, leadership and the supreme leader in Iran in particular, have accused Saudi Arabia of being unable to provide safety to pilgrims, of having neglected those who were injured in the stampede last year, of having murdered some of them. And those charges by the Iranians have been directed at delegitimizing Saudi Arabia's claim to being a leader of the Islamic world and the protector of the holy shrine in Mecca. So the Saudis have decided to meet Iranian rhetoric with equal rhetoric. So if you challenge our Islamic legitimacy, we're going to challenge your Islamic legitimacy, and we're going to up your challenge by actually not just going after you being a legitimate Islamic leader, but actually you being legitimately Muslim.
I mean, in a way, both countries are challenging the legitimacy of each other's existence, and that is more than just insults. Why now, do you think?
Well, the two countries are in loggerheads over influence in the Middle East. Since the United States has reduced its presence in the region, and we've had wars in Syria and Iraq where the fate of the region has been up for grabs, the Saudis are worried that Iran is ascendant, and the Iranians see Saudis as blocking their way and threatening their clients and interests in the region. Since both governments have Islam as a mainstay of their legitimacy, this strategic rivalry very quickly becomes sectarian and religious, because each side tries to undermine the other one by going for the jugular, which is Islamic legitimacy.
You know, Vali Nasser, Saudi Arabia and Iran always seem to be on the brink of deeper hostility, but always stopping short of war. What is next?
You could say they are involved in a significant conflict in the region. They're not confronting one another in a single battlefield with weapons directly facing one another, but they are actually engaged in a very intense proxy war in an arc that goes all the way from Syria to Yemen and Bahrain. I think it is possible to imagine that the two may end up in a hot conflict with one another. I think that's not likely. I think for the duration, we're going to see continued support for proxy activities around the region, but also we're going to see an escalation of the kind of rhetoric we saw this week as each side tries to gain more allies and support in the region among those who it believes will sympathize with its message.
Where does the U.S. fit in here? Because the U.S. helped negotiate a nuclear deal with Iran that will bring them into daylight, and the U.S. depends on Saudi Arabia still for oil. What can the U.S. do to help out?
it is not in the interest of the United States for Saudi and Arabia and Iran to be going at it in this manner and for tensions in the region to escalate, not just because Iran and Saudi Arabia may end up in a direct conflict, but because fixing Syria and Iraq and fighting ISIS would be impossible if these two countries are at one another's throat the way they are.
Vali Nasser, always good to get your thoughts on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Vali Nasser there, Dean of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. So Iran isn't sending any pilgrims to Saudi Arabia for the Hajj this year. And as we heard, it's all about what happened at the Hajj last year, a deadly stampede that left hundreds, perhaps thousands of pilgrims dead, many of them Iranian. The Saudi government has been dragging its feet about investigating what exactly happened. Reporter Sarah Al-Mukhtar has been digging into this for The New York Times. She spoke with one man, Rashid Siddiqui, who got caught up in the crush but survived.
Rashid is an American who is originally from India, but he's from Atlanta. He is an architect. He was working in Saudi Arabia at the time and decided to come back to Atlanta, but figured he should probably go on the Hajj before he came home while he was in the area.
What did Mr. Siddiqui tell you about how he and the people around him got stuck?
Well, it was kind of difficult, I think, for him to really be aware of what was happening. It all kind of happened before he could even react or register. He said there was a slow kind of buildup of pressure. And at first he thought, well, you know, we're at the Hajj, crowding is normal. And he had experienced a similar kind of crowding in the past when he was walking around the Kaaba, for example, during a busy time.
And the Kaaba is explain the Kaaba for us.
Yeah, the Kaaba is, you've probably seen a lot of images of this black cube with people walking around it. And that is in Islam considered to be the house of God. And it's the holiest place in Islam. So to him, it seemed like it could be a normal kind of crowding, right? But as the street was narrowing and the pressure was building, he noticed up ahead that some people were climbing the fences that lined the street. And then that's when he started thinking, okay, maybe something's wrong and maybe I should be trying to get out of this. But of course, you know, he had no chance to react. And all of a sudden he felt pushed and he fell two or three times, somehow managing to get up each time, but not really having control over his body or, you know, kind of what was happening around him. And he said, I asked him what it felt like physically. And he said he was barely even aware of what was happening physically, because in his mind, his only thought was, what's going to happen to my family? And I'm sure that this is my last day on earth. You know, that I'm sure that I'm about to die. But luckily, miraculously, he ended up being pushed backward and out of the main part of the crush about 10 or 15 minutes after it began.
Yeah, I mean, he calls it a miracle. It's kind of hard to figure out how he survived. He was with family who were not so lucky. Tell us what happened to the people he was with.
That's right. So he was walking in a small group with his brother-in-law and his brother-in-law's wife and two or three other couples who were their friends. So during the crush, though, he lost track of them. He didn't really notice until a little bit later on that they were missing. And throughout the day, he tried repeatedly to call them. There was no answer, of course. And then later that night, by the time he got back to his tent, he realized, okay, for sure, something's wrong and they're missing. So he and his family, his extended family, went on a search, spent days going to hospitals and morgues and trying to get information, trying to find his brother-in-law and his brother-in-law's wife. And eventually they were each confirmed to have died in the crush.
Yeah, really tragic. Do we know if the Saudi government is doing anything markedly differently this year to avoid what happened last year?
All we've seen are some reports in Saudi media. They mentioned that they'll be giving pilgrims electronic bracelets, which are like GPS enabled and will have identification and medical info. So I assume, you know, those could really help with identification of loved ones or, you know, locating loved ones.
But in terms of crowd management?
In terms of crowd management, we've heard of new cameras being installed. What I've seen is, I guess those cameras are installed around the Grand Mosque. I'm not sure exactly where or if new cameras were installed around the area of the crush. But then also they have new restrictions on when pilgrims can perform the stoning ritual. So they have certain scheduled times that they're allowed to do it. But also, not being an expert in crowd management, I'm not sure how that affects crowd management, whether it's, you know, whether it would be a successful way to help prevent a crush.
Sarah Al-Mukhtar with The New York Times, who co-wrote their story on the fatalities during last year's Hajj in Saudi Arabia. Sarah, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Marco.
According to the Guinness World Records website, the oldest any person has ever lived is 122. That record belongs to a French woman who died in 1997. The Guinness list only includes fully verified cases, which is not the case with an Indonesian man named Mbak Goto. He and his family say he was born in late 1870, meaning he's allegedly 145 years old. You're right to be skeptical about the story, so am I. But let's hear what my BBC colleague Rebecca Henschke found out when she visited Mbak Goto at his home on the island of Java.
Mbak Goto's grandson, Surianto, helps him sit down at his favorite wooden chair at the front of their house. From here, he can watch neighbors coming and going in his sleepy village that's surrounded by rice paddies. Mbak Goto says there's a simple secret to his long life, and that's always being patient and knowing that someone is there to love and look after him. Suyanto sits down next to him and hands him his cigarettes.
He is still a heavy smoker, but since he has been living with me, I give him filter cigarettes, not the traditional unfiltered ones he used to smoke. Looking after him is easy. He is very independent. But in the last 6 months, we have to help him bath and he needs to be spoon-fed. But that's fine.
Mbak Goto has outlived 4 wives, 10 siblings, and all his children. Suyanto says he never thought about how old Mbak Goto was and was very surprised when he found out from the provincial government census. The local head of the population records is Wayu Elwiyanto, and he believes Mbak Goto is indeed 145 years old, and that his identity card, which shows he was born on December the 31st, 1870, is correct.
We believe his documents are valid. Based on official documents and our interviews with him, when he could still communicate well, the information is all correct. On Independence Day, he was always invited to tell stories about the past. He would talk about the wars against Japan and the Dutch colonizers. He had a great memory. He is a great storyteller.
But he says Indonesia only started officially recording births in the 1900s, and there have been mistakes before. But Mbak Goto is not concerned. Over to the side of the house is a simple gravestone with his name engraved in it.
I don't want to keep on living. That's why I have prepared my gravestone, so that when I die, everything is ready. My gravestone has been bought, the funeral clothes are ready, and I have brought the land for my grave. When I die, please dress me after I have been bathed. Make sure I'm wearing all my funeral clothes, including long trousers and a tie. Right now, I just want to die, but it's not my time yet.
Mbak Goto, the Indonesian man who's allegedly 145 years old. Ending that report from my BBC colleague Rebecca Henschke in Java. You're tuned to The World. Doctors and activists in Aleppo in Syria have no doubt. They say a crowded rebel-held neighborhood in the city was attacked with chlorine gas yesterday, and that the stench of chlorine hung in the air long after the barrel bombs were dropped. The Syrian government denies its forces launched a chlorine attack. I spoke today with a resident of Aleppo. Abdul Kafi told me he rushed to a hospital yesterday to see how victims of the attack were doing.
I saw many patients lying on the ground because there were no enough beds for them. They were in very dangerous situation. Then they were, all of them were coughing. They were breathing difficulty. The children were crying in bad way. So the situation in general was horrific. It was very, very bad situation. Most of the casualties were children.
So did you happen to speak with any doctors at the hospital, and what did they tell you about the symptoms they were witnessing?
I couldn't talk to the doctors because they were so busy with the patients. Some of the patients vomit and like this. So they could know that this is a chlorine attack. Of course, the smell was so strong, and even their clothes have got this chlorine smell.
You smell that yourself at the hospital?
Yeah, exactly. I smell it in the hospital and I smell this in the place of the attack because I went directly to the place of the attack to see what's going on there. And the smell was half an hour later. I arrived half an hour later and the smell was so strong. You can't go there without putting a mask on your nose.
What did that area where these barrels of chlorine gas were dropped, what did this area look like after this attack?
Yeah. Sukkari neighborhood where the barrel bomb fell is one of the most populated one, and all the area is completely civilians. And you know, it's civilians for the number of children who were affected. And of course, the casualties were about 165. 100 of them were only children. It's exactly beside the market, the main market of the Free Port of Aleppo. It is coming. So people go there to the market to buy things, to prepare things for their children, to buy some clothes, you know, to make their children happy.
Speaking of children, I hear what sounds like kids behind you, Abdul. What am I hearing?
Just this is my daughter here. I have a daughter. She's 7 months.
Oh, congratulations on your
Thanks.
Newborn. Are you worried about her future living in Aleppo?
So much. You know that exactly when we are in siege now, under siege, I'm sorry. I always ask her for forgiveness because I will not go outside. But I know that in the future, this war will affect her so much. Until now, you know that I couldn't buy her anything from the markets. She needs many things. And exactly, for example, vaccine. She had to take vaccines 4 months ago. I couldn't find anyone here in Aleppo because of the siege. So really, I'm so worried. But nevertheless, she knows that I had to stay here to help my people because this is our land. We only wanted freedom. We wanted nothing else. So she will understand me maybe in the future.
Well, I'm sure you'll do what you have to protect her. Abdul, are you concerned about your own safety?
Here inside Aleppo, you don't think of safety at all because you go, you walk, you sleep. You live in a house. The rocket, the barrel bomb came. Either it kills you or you are safe. So this is how we live, okay? We don't think a lot of safety now because we can't run away of danger. We can't run away of death. Death here now is every day and everywhere. I sometimes get up at the morning. I turn on my mobile. I see that one of my friends died. For example, 2 days ago, one of my friends died here in my neighborhood by a sniper because my house is so close to the front line. This is how we live. We wake up, we know that many people died. We continue our life. Sometimes we will be the one who died. We don't know.
Abdul, thank you very much for sharing your thoughts today.
You're welcome.
Abdul Kafi lives in Aleppo, Syria, with his wife and 7-month-old daughter. The number of casualties from that suspected chemical attack in Aleppo is still not clear, but such attacks are sadly a familiar reality for many Syrian doctors. Dr. Mohammed Khatoub is with the Syrian American Medical Society. He's just across the Syrian border in the Turkish city of Gaziantep. But he says members of his organization in Syria were involved in treating some of the victims of yesterday's attack.
There were 2 deaths and more than over 100 patients, over 100 casualties. Mm. Over 40 of them were kids under 18 age, 15 women. It's very clear that it was a huge attack on a civilian neighborhood.
How do you even go about helping a patient who's been the victim of chlorine gas? Is there a way to save them?
We don't have a specific treatment for chemical attacks. We are just dealing with the symptoms, trying to save those lives. I witnessed chemical attacks, not chlorine itself, but I witnessed sarin. It depends upon the situation, about the rescue team, the capacity of the rescue team, if they have equipment to protect themselves and go inside the infected area to save the people, to evacuate the people in the suitable time. It depends also about the capacity of the hospital, if they can deal with all the patients that they receive in the same moment, because you will be receiving big number of patients. And you cannot, like in other kind of injuries, like just stop the bleeding and get back to the patient after 2 or 3 hours while you are treating the most critical cases. You cannot do this in chlorine and in other types of attacks. It's completely different.
Dr. Khatoub, I'm curious, where did you witness the sarin gas attack?
In East Ghouta, in the massacre of East Ghouta in August 2013.
So in Syria, in this current war?
Yeah.
So again, denial from Syria that they ever used chemical weapons. You say not true, you saw it.
I saw it myself. Yes, of course. I was one of the witnesses of the massacre in East Ghouta, and it's ongoing. Actually, 67 of those attacks happened after the UN Security Council resolution on September 2013, which says that the chemical arsenal of the Syrian government will be destroyed. Yesterday, when the attack happened in Aleppo, we have a delegation from the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW, in Gaziantep, just 60, 70 kilometers away from the location of the attack. This government is sending messages that they don't care about what's happening around them. They don't care about the investigations of the UN.
Dr. Khatoub, are you Syrian yourself?
Yeah, I'm Syrian.
Can you imagine a day, and when will that day be, when you can go back to your country?
I'm still here near because I still have hope that one day we'll be back to Syria. Yeah, this is why I'm still here. I'm trying to make pressure of everyone who can help in protection of Syrian people and at least decreasing the suffering of them.
Dr. Mohammed Khatoub with the Syrian American Medical Society speaking with us from the Turkish city of Gaziantep. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on the show, the first day of school in Fort McMurray, Alberta, the first day back since those wildfires there in May. You're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. A lot of Russians would like to see Donald Trump in the White House, including this man, a singer Trump once dubbed Russia's Michael Jackson.
He loves Russia and Russians. If Donald Trump will be president, we'll be much, much better, closer, and I pray for that.
From Russia with love, for Trump, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. When it comes to America's national security, GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump wants to spend big. Speaking in Philadelphia today, Trump proposed a military buildup that includes hundreds of new ships, submarines, and planes. He said they're needed to protect America from enemies like China, North Korea, and Islamic extremists. Trump did not mention Russia, not a surprise given his previous positive statements about Russia and its president, Vladimir Putin. On the other hand, for weeks now, there's been speculation that Russia likes Trump so much that it's actively trying to influence the U.S. election in his favor. Remember those hacked Democratic Party emails? According to surveys, a majority of Russians would prefer to see Trump in the White House instead of Hillary Clinton. From Moscow, my BBC colleague Steve Rosenberg reports on why Russia likes Trump.
On stage in Sochi, Russia's most famous pop star whips off his sequin-encrusted angel wings and launches into a love song. The singer, Filipp Kirkorov, has been called Russia's Michael Jackson. The man who called him that, by the way, was America's Donald Trump.
Oh, Donald Trump. Oh, my God. First time we met, we have a feeling that we know each other many, many, many years.
The two men have known each other many, many years. More than 20 years, in fact. Kirkorov has performed at Trump's casino. He was a judge at Trump's Miss Universe contest. he's been a guest in Trump's home. A President Trump, he believes, would be Russia's friend.
He was a very often guest of Russia, and he loved Russia and Russians. If Donald Trump will be president, the relationship between our country will be much, much better, closer, and I pray for that, because two big nations, two big countries, they must be friends.
And it's my honor to introduce Donald J. Trump.
And Philippe's friend is singing from the same hymn book.
If we could get along with Russia, wouldn't that be a good thing instead of a bad thing? Hillary Clinton says, how dare he like Putin? How dare he? What are we doing, folks? What are we doing?
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump has said he would consider recognizing Crimea as part of Russia. He's criticized NATO, and he suggested lifting sanctions against Russia. So how unusual is it for a U.S. presidential candidate to be so pro-Moscow?
Never happened. Never happened in the last 70 years or so.
Michael McFaul is a former U.S. ambassador to Moscow.
Trump says things about Russia, about Putin personally, that are way beyond convention for a Democrat or Republican candidate or for a politician in either party.
But why? Is Donald Trump, as some of his critics claim, a Putin plant, a Russian agent? Well, that may be giving Vladimir Putin rather too much credit. He's powerful, but perhaps not so powerful that he can fix a US election. Still, a recent cyber attack on the Democratic Party and the subsequent leaking of embarrassing emails was, suspects Michael McFaul, a Russian operation.
I think we know pretty definitively that Russian organizations hacked those emails and were on those systems. Second, we know that WikiLeaks dumped those emails to purposely damage Secretary Clinton as a candidate. What we don't know definitively, did the Russians give the emails to WikiLeaks or did they obtain them through a different source? And I fear we'll never know that. But that, of course, if it were true, that's a very direct attempt to influence the course of the elections here in America.
Moscow denies getting involved in U.S. politics. Maria Zakharova is spokesperson for the Russian Foreign Ministry.
We're not supporting Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, or others in any sort of domestic elections. It's not our business. It's up to American people to decide. I think it's a very clear and very honest and very respectful position.
Back at the pop concert, the Russian Michael Jackson cannot see what all the fuss is about.
I think it's good that Donald Trump loves Russia so much.
And if Donald Trump does become president of the United States,
I will congratulate him personally. I will write him a letter. Donald, go.
The BBC's Steve Rosenberg there reporting from Moscow. If Russians like what Donald Trump stands for, they might also understand what's being planned in the French city of Calais. They're building a wall that's supposed to prevent the movement of refugees, the people we've been hearing about for several years, people making their way to Europe from all over the world. Now, what's interesting here is that it's the UK that's benefiting from this wall, but it's being built on French soil. My BBC colleague Leo Hornack is in London. What's going on here, Leo? It sounds like France is building a wall. And the UK, is it going to pay for it?
Well, exactly. They're calling it the Great Wall of Calais. The situation, as you said, is that there is this French town. It's one of the closest parts of France to Britain. It's the narrowest strait in the sea between them. And this small French seaside town has become a magnet for undocumented migrants across Europe trying to reach Britain. Under a long-standing agreement, all the passport controls, all the border crossings are on the French side of the border, on the French side of the water. And to persuade the French to keep it that way, the British are having to agree to pay for more and more security measures to try and keep people from crossing into Britain. And this is only the latest stage in it. Now, the British have promised recently for an extra 20 million euros. That's about $22 million. Mm-hmm. The announcement today was that the French are going to spend that building this wall. It's going to be 13 feet high, running for most of a mile between the main road and the Calais port. And when the British minister announced that was discussing this plan, there was a bit of a question from an opposition politician who did ask whether this had been inspired by Mr. Donald Trump. And the answer from the British minister was that she couldn't really comment on that.
Okay, so you visited Calais, Leo. You've seen the conditions at this large refugee camp known as the jungle. Describe what we're talking about and the people who will be affected by this wall and their attempts to reach the UK from Calais.
It is an utterly strange place, Marco. You can be sitting in a French cafe in the town square one moment, having your croque-monsieur and looking at the seagulls playing, and then you just drive 5 minutes and you're suddenly in a completely different world. You're in essentially a shanty town of almost every nation on earth that's in the developing world. It's that contrast and that tension which I have a lot of sympathy with the ordinary residents of Calais, in fact, because the current situation is that they estimate around 20% of the population of Calais are now migrants in that camp.
Wow.
And there simply aren't the facilities. There's no running water. There simply aren't the facilities to provide for those people. And so those people are getting increasingly desperate. But it really goes further than that, because I visited it a year ago. And since then, estimates are that it's actually doubled in size, or the population has significantly increased, probably around to doubling. And that has just put this onto the front burner of all these questions that you have in the States and Europe has as well about how to deal with undocumented migrants as a population, how to deal with the fact that people are prepared to take enormous risks to cross borders, and yet at the same time, how do you balance that with the needs of the existing population who are abiding by the laws as they see it and see other people, you know, crossing borders, digging through fences and so on. How you manage to balance those two problems is something that I don't think anyone has really come close to grappling with. And a wall isn't going to probably move us towards a proper solution on that front.
Do you know if migrants are still arriving in Calais? And what's the attraction for them of moving on to the UK?
Of course, it's all clandestine, so I can't say for certain, but it's pretty well documented that the population of the camp has drastically increased in the last few months. This is part of the bigger pattern that, by and large, many of those people, once they reach Europe, don't really want to stay in the poorer southern states of Europe. Many of those people want to head to the richer countries of Germany or Scandinavia, or in this case, Britain. There's a number of routes by which they reach Britain from there. But one of the most popular, or one of the most successful, is to sneak onto long-haul trucks that are traveling from Europe to Britain. Mm. And then once you reach Britain, you disperse or you claim asylum. And I rode for a day with a trucker, a British trucker, traveling from Belgium all the way through France, through Calais to Britain. As you got closer, he would lock the doors. And he'd heard, and we've seen footage as well, of migrants creating things like roadblocks to try and slow down the traffic and then use the fact that the traffic's stationary to break into trucks and get on there. Now, I mean, as I say, there's not just two sides to this story. There's about eight sides to this story. Mm. So for every trucker who feels threatened, there is someone who's fleeing conflict in Syria who's desperate to start a new life.
My partner and colleague at the BBC in London, Leo Hornack, thanks very much for explaining this to us, Leo.
Thank you, Marco.
Last May, the picture we all saw of Fort McMurray in Alberta was one of smoke and fire. A huge wildfire spread rapidly through the city, destroying homes and businesses and leaving scores of residents homeless. The fire eventually spread across roughly 1.5 million acres and wasn't declared under control until early July. Now it's back to school time in Fort McMurray. Briar Stewart is a CBC reporter based in Edmonton in Alberta, and she's just returned from a visit up to Fort McMurray. Give us a snapshot, first of all, Briar. What does Fort McMurray look like today?
Well, Fort McMurray, in a lot of sections, really still looks a lot like it did back in May, and certainly back when residents started to return in June. Now, as for the 2,500 buildings that were destroyed, I mean, these are still in areas that are, for the most part, surrounded off by fencing, and demolition crews are going lot by lot. So some properties have been cleared, but it's a long process, and it's going to take several months.
Did the fires destroy any schools?
The fires basically damaged four schools, didn't destroy them, but there are four schools that will not be opening at all this year. And these were schools that were heavily damaged by smoke, by ash, by water. And restoration crews have been working throughout the summer, not only in those four schools, but in all the schools in the city, because they all had to be thoroughly cleaned. I mean, you had crews, hundreds of workers wiping down every single book in the school. So I think there was like 40,000 books that had to be wiped, cleaned, and then put back on the shelf. So it was really an immense job.
Yeah. So how is the city dealing with that fact that it has fewer schools to work with?
So they have some extra space in some other schools that have opened. So students that went to those four schools, they'll be shifting into new schools in new neighborhoods. But I also, you know, should mention that they are expecting to have fewer students in Fort McMurray this year. I mean, I was speaking with the superintendent of the public schools there. Last year, they had about 5,500 students in the public school system. In terms of enrollment this year, they expect it to be down somewhere between 10 and 20%. So that could be as many as 1,000 students not returning. And that's because for families who have lost their homes, in some cases, they may have lost their jobs because, of course, this is a city dealing with a downturn in the price of oil. So, I mean, the economy is not what it once was up there. And because of that, you are seeing some families simply not returning.
So a school year abruptly abbreviated, did the students you spoke with seem excited to be back?
The two students I spoke with are from a family that lost their home, and they basically just returned to the city because their experience, I think, was similar to a lot of families where they didn't bring their children back right away into the city because, I mean, at first when people were allowed to come back, there were concerns over air quality. There was a boil water advisory in place. And for people who lost their homes, I mean, they had to find some place to live. So these two young girls that I spoke with, they were, you know, I would say somewhat excited to be back. They were happy to be going back to school because they would get to see some of their friends again. But, you know, I think for them, there was just still so much uncertainty, and it's been such a summer of upheaval that it was really the parents that were excited to see their children go back to school because, for one, it would help give them some structure, some routine, which they, you know, desperately were missing throughout the summer, but also give their parents time to work on things like the insurance claims and to start moving forward with the process of rebuilding.
How much school did those kids in Fort McMurray actually miss, and how much catch-up do they have to do now?
Well, so the school year ended abruptly in May when everybody had to leave Fort McMurray. And so a lot of the children, because they were really scattered across the country in different cities, they enrolled in schools, you know, wherever it was that they ended up. So, you know, the school year will be starting fresh. And I should say that, you know, the schools, as they're reopening here, they're having more mental health counselors on hand. That's because there's a real concern that, you know, students could be struggling with the aftermath of the fire and some of those memories, because when people had to flee the city, a lot of the students left directly from the school. So it was, you know, very chaotic for them. The one little girl I was speaking with, she finished up the school year in Nova Scotia. Her parents were actually called to the school one day because the 9-year-old was having flashbacks. She thought the schoolyard in Nova Scotia was on fire. So this is something that the children are dealing with, which is why over the summer, the public school board basically sat down and came up with a mental health strategy to talk about the different kinds of support they want to have in place, you know, as the school year continues, because they said there's going to be challenges throughout the year, you know, not just in the initial first days, but what happens when they have the first fire drill, for instance? Could that be a potential trigger for some of these students?
Briar Stewart with the CBC, who's just visited Fort McMurray, Alberta, where kids headed back to school today for the first time since that wildfire last May. Briar, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Fresh off the Summer Olympic Games, Rio now turns its attention to hosting the Paralympics. More than 4,000 athletes with disabilities will compete in 23 sports over the next 11 days. While they're in town, they might want to buy some togs from the designer whom The World's Will Carlos met recently. His name is Cristiano Cross, from the city of God Favela, or Cidade de Deus in Portuguese. And Cross worked with local women with disabilities to create a line of clothing that's truly inclusive. Here's Will's story.
In his tiny one-room studio deep in Cidade de Deus, Cross hunches over a sewing machine. He lives in a modest house attached to the studio. He says he started to dream up the project studying design at a local college.
I always had this concept that in fashion, you should be useful instead of useless, he says. So I told my professor, I have this idea. I'm going to make fashion for people with physical disabilities, because there's nothing like that on the market. And that's where this idea came from. Kroos says he was amazed to find that there was no shop in Brazil selling clothes tailored specifically for people with disabilities. There's nothing in all of Brazil, he says. Incredible as it seems, nothing. So Kroos got to work. He contacted organizations that help people with disabilities across Rio and began talking to women about the problems they have with the clothes they buy off the rack at regular stores. They told him dresses in particular weren't designed with different body shapes in mind or with the practicalities of using a wheelchair or crutches. So he began to design clothes that would make life easier for them and their families. He says, my clothes have Velcro, zips, pieces that can be split into two, for example, a top and a skirt that join together to make a dress. I have clothes that are labeled with Braille, so someone who has difficulty seeing knows if they're putting on a blouse or a dress. That's the whole concept of this project, making things easier. Kroos's clothes are designed to be easy to put on and take off, and some items include hidden compartments or openings so that people with prosthetic devices like colostomy bags can easily access them. While he knew he was doing something different, Kroos didn't want to create a line that's only for women with disabilities. That would just set these women further apart from the mainstream, he says. Growing up in one of Rio's toughest neighborhoods, he knows all about what it's like to be an outsider. The Xixi fashion world doesn't take too kindly to kids from the ghetto, he says. He wanted his clothes to rise above all that. My brand is called Inclusive Wear, he says. So a woman who doesn't have a disability can wear it. A black woman can wear it. A plus-size woman can wear it. And a woman with disabilities can wear it. Kroos says the feedback he gets continues to inspire him. I've heard some really emotional stories, he says. Once I started to make them clothes, people said to me, Cristiano, you've given me my life back. I feel beautiful. I feel sexy. I feel desirable. Kroos says he dreams of one day opening a store that really does cater to everyone. All genders, rich or poor, big, small, black, white, in a wheelchair, on crutches. It's not just about looking good, he says. It's about increasing confidence, increasing awareness, increasing your self-worth. For the world, Will Carlos, Rio de Janeiro.
Before we go today, let's make a stop on the shores of Issyk-Kul Lake. To orient yourself, that's in Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia. And it just so happens to be where some of the world's best falcon hunters, archers, and bareback horse racers are competing currently. The World Nomad Games are underway there. Actor Steven Seagal, noted nomad, showed up in local garb astride a horse in the opening ceremonies. But we're not here to talk about him. Amos Chappell is a photographer for Radio Free Europe. Amos, I just am curious to know what you feel is like your most spectacular picture you've gotten so far from the games.
Probably the best picture, or the picture that I was luckiest to get, was during the opening ceremony. And it was held during the nighttime, and the lighting wasn't great. Everyone was struggling a little bit. But there was a moment when some Turkmen horse riders came into the stadium, and there's this ripple of respect, you know, that runs through the crowd because everyone knows that the Turkmen are the best horse riders in Central Asia. And the picture that I got was of this sort of posse of horse riders. There were two horses galloping side by side, a man sitting on each horse, a man standing on each horse, and at the very top, standing on the shoulders of the two men, was a small boy of about 12 with his arms out, like Titanic style, grinning and smiling. And as the horses were galloping across the stadium, and that brought the house down, and I was lucky enough to get one frame of that, which was perfectly sharp. And I think it's a strong image, probably the strongest I have.
I saw a photograph you took of what seems to be two wrestlers, but they're pushing against each other with their feet.
Right, yeah, that's called mass wrestling. And it's, two guys sitting down heel to heel and trying to pull themselves over a small wall, and they're both holding on to a wooden stick. And it looks like it's just a sort of brute force. Well, it sounds perhaps like it's just a brute force thing, but watching it, it's actually fascinating to watch because there are tactics, And it seems to be a bit of a mind game for some of these people as well. Some of them scream and yell and grunt, and others sort of shimmy sideways back and forth along the wall. The aim is either pull the stick out of your opponent's hand or pull him or her over the wall.
Then there is horseback archery. I suppose it is what it sounds like, but tell us more about horseback archery.
Yeah, so it was a great event photographically, because you're trying to get the moment when the horse is off the ground and the arrow is just coming out of the bow, you know, which I didn't quite manage, but almost. And speaking to one of the guys after the event, he told me how difficult it is mentally. He said, you're galloping, you know, you're going at full speed on the horse, and you're also trying to shoot with your bow. So if you think too hard about shooting your arrow, you can fall off your horse. Huh. But if you think too much about riding your horse, you'll miss the target, you know. So it's this kind of tug of war mentally as to what you need to concentrate on more. But he said it's very, very dangerous.
So I've got to ask you about the Central Asian tradition of falcon hunting.
It was amazing to see these birds up close. They look so alien and merciless, these creatures. I was at one stage sitting down next to a big eagle with its hood on, you know, so it can't see. And it was distressed about something. It was sort of calling and jumping about. And his owner, a 16-year-old kid, came and sat down, picked up the bird, and actually held his cheek against the cheek of the bird.
Wow.
And it instantly calmed it down. Like, there's a real connection between this vicious-looking bird of prey and these, you know, young boys and young men.
I'm wondering if you came away, Amos, with kind of a strong impression of what nomadic culture actually is in 2016.
I was struck by young, you know, trendy, good-looking young people who see this culture as something which is genuinely cool. You know, there's a real respect here amongst all generations for horsemanship and for the traditional craft that they have here. It's not only that this isn't a dying culture, it feels like a growing culture.
Amos Chappell is a photographer with Radio Free Europe. Amos, that's great stuff.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've got Amos's photos of those Turkmen horse riders galloping into the World Nomad Games. They're at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. See you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.